Oh, you know what we never played? We never played the School Sucks at the Movies theme song.
Do we have one?
Yeah, I made it.
Oh.
Best films of the 1990s was Goodfellas. Now, its style is completely different, isn't it? It's like twice as fast as New York, New York. Yeah. Why is it so fast, and where did you get the new style from?
The new style comes purely from, I should say, comes from a pure state of excitement how I first really heard, like, the famous storytellers, where you would have storytellers go from village to village in the old world. Well, a lot of guys would stand on street corners, where I was from. And some were excellent storytellers, funny and self-deprecating, and conjure up images so quickly, you know? And they were tough kids, very tough people. And I'd always say, boy, imagine to make a film with that kind of speed and excitement and humor, which makes the way of life in the film at first extremely romantic and appealing. But then, of course, one begins to pay for it, and you begin to see what the lifestyle really is about. You know, just a dead end, a moral, spiritual dead end, you know. And in some cases, just death, totally death. I mean, people are killed, put away in jail, you know, it's just a joke. And the life expectancy, the early 20s, late 20s, that sort of thing. But in any event, I'd also got a little annoyed by the aspect that was happening in American films, where things had to go faster and faster. I said, well, if you want it fast, I'll give it to you really fast. Let's go real fast on this one. And because that's the lifestyle, it is fast. And you suddenly, yes, true, you get stopped by a bullet or a bat in the head or a cop putting you in jail, in and out of jail. But, you know, up to that point, it's pretty fast, and you have a great time.
And what I've got here is the ending of the picture, yeah. Where he has ratted on his colleagues, yeah. And now he has to go and live in isolation in,
yes,
suburbia.
What's
the tone of this ending?
The tone of it is like, you know, he has the nerve to be complaining, and you're watching this. Well, what do you feel about it?
Today everything is different. There's no action. I have to wait around like everyone else. Can't even get decent food. Right after I got here, I ordered some spaghetti with marinara sauce, and I got egg noodles and ketchup.
I remember Paul Schrader telling me, Marty, you know, you should have that chain, that ending chain, he said, because people don't want to be sitting there for 2 hours and 20 minutes for a guy who reacts that way at the end of the film. And I said, but that's the kind of people I kind of knew growing up. I said, I just wanted to deal with it realistically. And we dare you to get annoyed in the audience, you know? It's like a provocation of the audience, really.
Mm-hmm. And it's about the sort of mundanity of life. He's moved into a mundane world rather,
yes,
than an exciting but scary world.
You know, yeah, exactly. But, you know, I'm not saying people should live this way, but what I'm saying is that I want them to understand the thinking. And if the thinking provokes you into anger, well, that's life.
Hmm. Okay, let's have a look at it.
Didn't mean anything. When I was broke, I would go out and rob some more. We ran everything. We paid off cops.
See?
Paid off lawyers,
and everything worked out.
Judges, everybody had their hands out.
The judges, particularly. You don't tell me where I have to go because I know what you paid for that seat.
And now it's all over. And that's the hardest part.
And there's a terrible sense of regret, too, isn't there?
Oh, but a regret for it's ironic because a regret for what?
For a good life.
For his idea of a good life, which was, you know, what we had seen for the past 2 hours. It's madness. He's complaining about marinara sauce.
An average nobody. Get to live the rest of my life like a schnook.
And why that? Now, this character's already dead in the movie.
Well, that's a reference right to the end of The Great Train Robbery, Edwin S. Porter. That's the way that ends, that film. And basically, the plot of this picture is very similar to The Great Train Robbery. It hasn't changed. It's 90 years later. It's the same story. The gunshots will always be there. He's got to always look behind his back. He's got to have eyes behind his head, as they used to say, because they're going to get him someday.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is January 7th, and what you're going to hear today is our review and discussion loosely based on the new Martin Scorsese film, The Wolf of Wall Street. And Jeffrey Tucker will join us later in this program. So if you're totally unfamiliar with this subject matter, the first 4 minutes might have been somewhat confusing. It was a clip of Martin Scorsese discussing the film Goodfellas, and that was on a program called Scene by Scene, where directors sit with an interviewer and watch clips from their film and then talk about those clips. Now, I'll tell you why this is important to me to include this material at the beginning of the show. For a long time, we're going back into my college days, I found Martin Scorsese. Again, if you're totally unfamiliar, the director of films like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Goodfellas, Casino, The Departed, and what we're going to be talking about today, The Wolf of Wall Street, to be a very inspirational figure. It's hard to find somebody who loves what they do, is more passionate about what they do, and more knowledgeable about what they do than this man. And on my list of favorite films of all time, maybe only one or two would be Scorsese's films. But I would certainly consider him to be my favorite filmmaker for just the love and intensity and, again, expertise and craftsmanship that he demonstrates in everything he does and everything that he says about movies. So you heard that one clip where he's kind of talking about some of the themes that are very prevalent in the film Goodfellas. The movie we're going to be discussing today, The Wolf of Wall Street, incredibly similar movie in many ways, and that's why I chose to use that clip. And I'm going to play you one more from a documentary about the making of Goodfellas, and it is an interview with Martin Scorsese's editor, Thelma Shoemaker, and she not only edited Goodfellas, but also The Wolf of Wall Street, and many of his other films. And the other voices that you'll hear in this clip include Scorsese, Ray Liotta, who is the star of Goodfellas, and Michael Chapman, who's the director of photography in Goodfellas, or cinematographer. It's a discussion clipped from a 30-minute documentary that I'll link in the show notes about process and style, and you see a lot of the same things in The Wolf of Wall Street. So I thought I would just include these clips so you could get a sense of why this was important to me as a subject to share on the show. And after this clip, we will move into our live recording from last Friday. We're going to read and discuss an article from the Libertarian Standard called The Wolf of Wall Street by Jacob Hubert. And after that, we'll move into our discussion with Jeffrey Tucker. So I hope you enjoy this show. More stuff coming soon. Thanks for listening, everyone. Here we go.
When he's in the editing room, he can then relax and sit and just with complete and utter control finish making his movie. And a great deal of Marty's movies are made in the editing room, particularly The Last Day as a Wise Guy, as we call it. Last Day as a Wise Guy is a sequence that I think came together particularly in the editing room because we could we found that we could express the state of mind that Ray Liotta was in at that time, being coked up and completely out of control.
It was written in a lot of small montages, but it was never really visualized on the script the way you see it on film.
For example, when Ray Liotta plunks the guns, the camera swish pans up to him. I just always enjoy all the strange jump cutting that we did, you know, Ray Liotta making veal cutlets and how we just jumped around and just experimented and just had a hell of a lot of fun violating every rule there is.
During the previews, the audience got annoyed, so I made it even faster, more relentless in a way.
We can make it even more jagged. We can make it more fractured. And so we started doing more jump cuts.
What I love about it is the annoyance. at having to go bring the guns to Jimmy, knowing damn well Jimmy's not going to buy them.
Stop with those fucking drugs. They're making your mind into mush.
That should put you in a position to say, what am I doing in my life? No, he's annoyed that I know Jimmy's going to make me bring this around. He's not going to want. I'm going to put him back in the trunk. I'm going to have to go over here. I've got to stir the sauce. I swear this helicopter's following me, but that, I didn't pay attention to that. I think it is. No, it isn't. Picking up his brother. Drugs, coke, girlfriends. They're hiding guns in garbage pails. And it goes on like that. Everything seemed to be of the same importance. All the same level. He could not differentiate by that point.
Total madness.
That's Henry's life. You know, I know he's stoned, and this is his vision of it is that. But that was Henry's life.
You know, we did our jobs, and, you know, we had great makeup, and they made us look all whacked out. But talk about music and editing.
Everything gonna be all right this morning.
Let's go shopping.
Marty had such great ideas about how to put music to some of those images. Some of it he had already pre-planned. Some of it he put into it, the film in the editing room. Will you take part in? He has a deep sense of how music should go with a film. And by that, I don't mean that it should go easily. Sometimes it's a shocking choice, but it works like crazy.
I kind of see everything with music, especially the juxtaposition of the type of music you're listening to the images that you see out the window, and that sort of thing. And I said, that's the way music should be in a movie.
That was the first time I had ever seen anyone shot.
You remember where you ever heard first?
Usually a piece of music. I remember when I first heard it.
Where, with your mother in a butcher shop. Or...
Yeah, yeah.
And he'll carry those pieces of music around for years and then suddenly find exactly the right place for that piece. Each shot was designed to certain bars of Layla.
We had the music already played on the set to get the right rhythm for the movement or for the length of a scene.
And when I got in the editing room, then I had to make sure that I was trying to get exactly what he wanted. He was very specific about how he wanted the music to cut.
Let's try this. It's really on the way.
Yeah.
Right here. We start.
Goodfellas was one of those films that I felt we rode like a horse. It was so beautifully scripted and shaped by Nick Leggi and Marty that it had its own energy, it had its own drive, and as Marty was laying it down, it just had an incredible feeling to it. So we were sort of riding it and trying to stay on top of it and stay ahead of it if we could, but it was so strong. It had such a rhythm.
Oh, you broke it, Jerry!
The movie has such an effect on people that no one expected. I mean, it's just such a it's just such a grip.
What I found in my experience is that there are certain films that you don't preview, and certainly this is one. And that's when we got our head handed to us. When we took this in front of audiences, we got killed.
The audience got really, in some cases, almost violent.
We had maybe 40 walkouts in the first 10 or 15 minutes.
When they were giving their cards back, they were like throwing their cards and writing profanities on them.
The people who saw it from the studio at first, they could see how incredibly entertaining it was, what an amazing film it was. But they were nervous about the drugs.
We had a lot of problems with them on the cut. They wanted to cut out the violence.
Which was impossible, because that's what the movie was about. So he did have to fight very hard for that. And it was remarkable to watch him, his courage and his conviction and the fact that he just would never give up, but was very good at explaining why it was important to retain the material.
And we're able to get the film that Marty wanted on the screen.
You know, when you're working on something like this, you just try to make it as good as you can. And even in the end, neither of us, we would be still not totally satisfied. And I remember literally at the opening of the movie, I think it was at the Ziegfeld or somewhere, and I'm sitting next to him. They got us in tuxedos, and we're sitting next to him, thing goes up, and then all of a sudden I get this elbow. He says, I told you, I should have. And he started talking about editing, and you'd think he was in the editing room. I said, Marty, forget it. It's over. It's too late. And he laughed. But, you know, even watching it on opening night, there's still things you can tweak and things you can deal with. I don't think he's ever going to say, I've finally done it. This is perfect. You'll never hear that from him.
So we're going to read through this and we're going to pause occasionally. Jeffrey Tucker is going to join us at about 7:45. He has read this as well, so this might contribute to our discussion at that point. Murray Rothbard, the great libertarian theorist and economist, hated Goodfellas. He especially hated the depiction of gangsters as psychotic punks whose violence was random, gratuitous, and pointless. He preferred the Godfather films, where the gangsters never engaged in violence for the hell of it or random kicks, but only used it to enforce contracts the government, police, and courts wouldn't uphold. For Rothbard, Goodfellas' unflattering portrait of gangsters was practically a smear on libertarianism itself. According to him, organized crime is essentially anarcho-capitalist, a productive industry struggling to govern itself, which provides consumers with products such as gambling, drugs, prostitution, imports that the government has arbitrarily and unjustly made illegal. So he was offended by Goodfellas, where the organized criminals are little different from street criminals and are defeated by the cops at the end. I can see that.
We have a lot of romanticizing of the criminal element that goes on in our libertarian circles. I know I certainly do it myself.
What kind of criminals do you romanticize?
Just like drug dealers. I remember writing a paper when I was in college of drug dealers as heroes of the market.
Well, yeah. And I think that there's a line that you cross, though, right? Where you become less like anarcho-capitalist and more like the government.
Right.
And that's the point. And I guess the question that you have to ask yourself is the threat of violence propping up my whole operation? So I don't even, when I read this, the first couple paragraphs in this article, I was like, what is he even talking about? How could Murray Rothbard, and then, I mean, this all relates to the Wolf of Wall Street. I can't imagine that Rothbard would have been very sympathetic to that kind of crime. He was very, very critical of Wall Street. And I recommend that people read Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy. And Rothbard, you know, does for most of us, it's thorough enough as far as his research. He wrote it in the early 80s. And, you know, he shows how private interests, they're not really private interests because they're using the government to enrich themselves. They're using the violence of the government to make money for themselves. And we're talking about, you know, the Rockefellers, J.P. Morgan, the Rothschilds, those, the original old guard. So, yeah, I don't think Rothbard would have been very sympathetic to this film's characters either.
No.
But, yeah, there is a romanticism that I think The Godfather introduced people to when it comes to the mafia, that they were, you know, men of respect. And I'm sure a lot of people in organized crime see themselves that way. And maybe, you know, if you work your way up, you can be a respectable man in the mafia. But now, in the beginning,
it's been a while since I've seen The Godfather films, but those guys were much more about the gambling racket, right, than anything else. Like, I don't remember them, you know, taking protection money from small business owners and
you don't
things
see
like that.
Yeah.
Or just the hijacking of cargo, like in Goodfellas. That's basically what that was all about, right?
Yeah. It seems like the story as it unfolds in the second movie is that Vito Corleone is essentially a victim of the Black Hand, that he rises up to protect the people of this Little Italy neighborhood from this much more malicious gangster called the Black Hand and goes into the legitimate olive oil importation business and occasionally has to do some violence to right wrongs along the way. It's a very romantic portrayal of a gang. And he is shown to be violent. You know, there are some very violent scenes in those movies. And a murder is kind of like a last resort.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, well, we've exhausted all our other options.
And people generally deserved it, right? It wasn't like Joe Pesci style, stabbing someone in the eye with a pen because he gets pissed.
Right. But that's a trait of Martin Scorsese's movies, and it goes beyond the gangster genre. Like in all the people that are center stage in his movies, including The Wolf of Wall Street, are bad people. And that's kind of the trick of his way of storytelling. You find yourself in the middle of one of Scorsese's movies, you say, am I rooting for this guy? And I think that's a really confronting thing. And that's an interesting interactive feature in Martin Scorsese's movies. And I think a lot of other people have tried to imitate it, in some cases pretty recklessly. I mean, I think Tarantino is an okay filmmaker, but he's also like, hey, come, let's have fun and root for bad guys, you know, kind of thing. But it's a way of involving the audience in the movie and really like making you ask questions about yourself, or I should maybe just apply it to me personally, ask questions about myself. Like, how am I like this guy, you know? And The Wolf of Wall Street is the same thing. And there's also nothing interesting about watching people do what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like let's make a three-hour movie about, you know, people providing valuable financial services. He wants to find bad people, or at least people, if they're not bad people, because I think redemption is a theme in a lot of his movies, like definitely in Raging Bull, in Taxi Driver to a certain extent. People who are struggling, people who are doing bad things, but they want to find some kind of redemption. And it even, didn't you even feel like it kind of came through at the end of the Wolf of Wall Street, where you're just like, this can't get any worse. And then he's, you know, the end of the movie, he's doing like motivational speaking, right?
Right.
Back to the article. Some libertarians may dislike Goodfellas director Martin Scorsese's latest, The Wolf of Wall Street, for similar reasons. And those, you know, same idea as that Goodfellas formula. People who are so reckless that they just aren't smart enough in the end to avoid the silly cops. This film tells the story of a stockbroker, Jordan Belfort, who cares about nothing but money and gratifying himself. His startup Long Island brokerage takes off when he and his cohort start pushing penny stocks on working class investors by cold calling them and convincing them they can get rich quick by investing in purportedly great companies that are actually terrible. Belfort makes even more money by using third parties to invest in some of the companies whose stock he pushes and stashes the profits in a Swiss bank account. Meanwhile, Belfort and his colleagues' lust for money leads quickly to Caligula-style decadence with nonstop sex and drugs parties in and out of the office, which the movie dwells on at length. It sure does.
Yes, at length. Pretty much the entire movie is drugs,
yeah,
and weird sex.
I was telling you at dinner, I was debating going to see the movie with my mom. I'm glad I saw it with you first, because that would have been very uncomfortable.
That's good. So another lesson for all you boys and girls. If there's a movie that you want to watch that you don't want your mother to see, just take Osborne instead.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just as Goodfellas never acknowledged the valuable services Rothbard believed the mafia historically performed, The Wolf of Wall Street never acknowledges the essential services that stockbrokers provide in a market economy. A character played by Matthew McConaughey, who, like Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross, appears just once early on to deliver a memorable greed-stoking speech, claims that stockbrokers don't create anything, but just pointlessly move money around while taking a cut for themselves. Now, we could disagree with...
Tell that to truck drivers, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you guys don't create anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're just worthless sacks who just take your cut by moving things around the country.
But there's more nuance to the stock market than that. It's not just one thing. And there's two very different types of investment that are happening there. You know, one is people... planning for the long term. And what we've seen a huge increase in the last 30 years is speculation. And people should certainly be free to speculate, just like people should be free to gamble. And I don't think most people who are investors and are putting a lot of money into the market, I would think a very low percentage of it would be in speculative investments like that. And people might play around with that, but I would that would never be a good chunk of anyone's portfolio.
I don't even know how we would test that notion.
Well, it wouldn't make any sense. I mean, there would be way too much volatility. I mean, there would be no point in investing, because it would be like trying to make a living gambling. And some people try to do it, but Why go through the work?
The insider trading laws are what make it a gamble, right? Because the people who have the information aren't allowed to reveal the information.
Right, right. At some point, libertarians may be tempted to walk out, assuming that the rest of the movie will be an attack on capitalism. But walking out for that reason would be a mistake, and criticizing the movie for that character's statements would be misguided, just as Rothbard's criticism of Goodfellas was misguided.
I wonder who he's talking about here.
Hmm. Now, that's interesting, because at 7:45, we're going to talk to a libertarian.
Oh, who walked out? Coincidence.
But maybe, I don't think, do you think this guy and Tucker know each other?
Oh, absolutely. I've talked to them in the same room.
Oh, okay. So maybe that's who he is talking about, because I saw, the reason why I asked Jeffrey Tucker, aside from just having an excuse to have Jeffrey Tucker on the show, is that I saw him post on Facebook that he walked out of the movie.
Yeah, I believe you immediately texted me and said, we have to see this movie. Jeffrey Tucker walked out.
Yeah, yeah, because I was so sure that I was going to like it, because it's Martin Scorsese, and like he could only be getting better at his craft, you know? I mean, The Departed, I thought
like
was...
George Lucas. Oh, wait, that's not how it works.
Poor George Lucas. Well, I mean, I think Martin Scorsese has really benefited from the way film has changed over the last 15 years or so. And what I mean by that is, like, he really seems like he's been able to grab the digital conversion. And Goodfellas and Raging Bull are absolutely amazing movies, made the old way, that I don't think he could ever, you know, reach that level again. But I guess I was holding out hope for The Wolf of Wall Street, that it was going to be this 21st century Goodfellas style movie, because I could feel it in the trailer, like what the pace of the movie was going to be. The length of the movie, it was going to be fast and furious and thorough. And I have to say that I was really excited, because I thought we were going to be debating Jeffrey Tucker. The movie was not that good. It was entertaining. Jonah Hill is great. Leonardo DiCaprio is good in everything. Matthew McConaughey has a funny scene.
Mm.
But it says Rothbard failed to mention that Goodfellas, unlike The Godfather, was a true story. Those characters did do those things more or less. In fact, the mafia does not just engage in defending the undefendable style heroism by providing black market goods and services. It also engages in theft, insurance fraud, protection rackets, vending machine rackets, and other thuggery. And who carries out those activities? Thugs, of course. Mediocrities who see gangsterism as their chance to become a big shot, like Ray Liotta's Henry Hill, and psychos who see an outlet for their violent inclinations, like Joe Pesci's Tommy DeVito. That's also in Goodfellas. Come to think of it, if we want to use the movie to make a libertarian point, we might observe that government attracts similar lowlifes for the same reasons. Absolutely,
yes.
True.
Well, I was just going to say, the first part of that paragraph there sounds like he was talking about government people. And that's why I was a huge fan of the show that was on Showtime called Brotherhood. Did you ever see this?
No.
Is about these. This is supposedly, you know, loosely based on real characters in Rhode Island. One brother was a politician, and the other was a more traditional gangster. And the whole show was really kind of a comparison of the two of their lives and how they were basically the same.
Yeah, HBO did a version of the Gotti story about 12 years ago. And it starred Amon DeSante and like all the people who wound up being on The Sopranos. But it was, that was a recurring theme in the movie, because, I mean, Gotti was always being dogged by, you know, a rival gang run by Rudy Giuliani, you know, all through New York, all through the 1980s.
Mm.
And that he repeatedly stresses that point. We're doing the same things they are, you know? And that was another thing that I think is worth stressing about The Wolf of Wall Street, is that he is hunted by not only the FBI, but the SEC. They pick winners and losers as well, especially the SEC, that has a very strange revolving door that goes from Wall Street to Central Intelligence through the SEC. And, you know, something like 6 out of 7 of the first directors of the Central, I think it was 6 out of 7, of the first directors of Central Intelligence came from Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, you see that in every government agency. It's all made up of people who came from that sector that they're regulating, and then they go out of that agency back into the sector, getting higher paid jobs than they had before. And it's really kind of a twisted, but completely expected, right? Like, how could it work any other way?
Right.
Like, we also have, you know, private industry associations. Like, in my industry, we have the American Collectors Association, right? And
yeah,
those are made up of, you know, people who own collection agencies, as you'd expect, right? Because who else is going to know about how this stuff works?
Right, right.
Right? But the difference between them and a government agency is they're not holding a gun to anyone's head and telling them what to do and playing favorites and squashing the little guy and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Hmm. Whether you see a movie showing the real-life violence those people carry out is up to you. Randians, I assume, would argue that art shouldn't depict anything so ugly, but should instead show us man at his best, so they wouldn't want to see it. But I, for one, find it interesting to get a glimpse of just how such people think and live, and Scorsese could not have done a better job telling their story. I have no complaints about Goodfellas. Now, I think this is a point worth expanding on here. And I think it was, you know, this guy's a great writer, and I think this is a wonderful article, but I think this deserves another paragraph. I would be more concerned if people were really interested in seeing people do the right things. The fact that people doing the wrong things is more entertaining, hopefully.
It means it's more unusual.
And foreign, right? So it doesn't bother me that the news is filled with horrible stuff. Right. And obviously it's mostly dominated by politics. So that's all horrible stuff. But even when it deals with private citizens, you know, this person murdered this person, you know, drove through a mall in their car and hit shoppers. If the news was like today, you know, a man helped a woman cross the street and there were several eyewitnesses and we'll go to the, you know, to the scene for interviews where people are stunned, that would be troubling. You know, so and I just want to reiterate what I said about Scorsese before. He wants you to look at bad people and sympathize with what bad people do. There's conflict in all of us, right? And I think he can really pull that out of people. I mean, that's my experience, that he wants to make you squirm in your chair while you say, "Am I rooting for a psychopath?"
Yeah, yeah. Or think about, what qualities does this person share that I do, and what's keeping me from going down that same path that he chose?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a very, very interesting question to ask. The Wolf of Wall Street is not a masterpiece like Goodfellas, but I approve of it for similar reasons. It too is based on a more or less true story. We can't know whether Balfour fabricated or exaggerated details in the memoir on which it's based. If the office orgies shown actually happened, one would think a hostile work environment lawsuits would have shut the place down long before the SEC or the FBI noticed it. But the parts about Balfour's stock trading are basically correct, as far as I know. And I don't doubt that some stockbrokers are, in fact, jerks whose views aren't much different than those of the McConaughey character. After all, most of them aren't economists, so why would they understand the important role they play in the economy, or how the economy works beyond what's necessary for them to do their sales jobs? Absolutely. And I think compartmentalization gets a lot of stuff done. You know, and ignorance is very important. And I think if most people don't ever understand the principles behind libertarianism or voluntarism, there's no real scale that comes into this. It's like, oh, this is really the right thing, when you tip it on the other side with so much money, what large sums of money like that very, very quickly can do as far as kicking in the rationalization machine. And one thing that I've noticed from people that I've known who worked on Wall Street is they become very hostile to ordinary people. Maybe in some ways that libertarians do, right? But it's part of them justifying what they do, perhaps. So it's almost kind of like a Darwinism. So a lot of angry libertarians are going around calling people sheep. They say it's because, well, you know, I want people to change. I want people to be better. They need to wake up. You know, that's what everyone says. But the justification from the people that I've talked to who used to work on Wall Street are like, yeah, people are stupid and they deserve it. It's their job to know better than to fall for this shit. And if they don't, then they deserve it. And they're stupid. You know, it's the work that I do, sad but true, that keeps this economy going, right? Because I think this would have crashed out a long time ago if there wasn't all of this fake wealth being pumped through Wall Street.
Yeah, and all the clouding of reality that comes with all the government regulations. I don't doubt for a second that in a free market, this guy's company that he started would have lasted more than 5 minutes.
In a completely free market?
Yeah. I mean, no one would do business with someone like that.
Why not? You think some people just wouldn't?
Because they're super shady. People would find out about it in no time flat. And in general, you don't do business with people who just started up yesterday. You know, you give them a try, maybe. You'd be like, oh, okay, all right, I'll give you $100, see how that works.
Yeah.
I mean, I do that all the time. That doesn't usually work out, but sometimes it does. And if it works out, then you keep doing business with them.
Right. So what's wrong with making a movie about those people? Nothing. As long as the movie holds one's interest and doesn't try to make a broader point about all stock trading being evil. And I don't feel like it did that at all. The Wolf of Wall Street passes the test. There are a few vague allusions to the 1% and Wall Street's role in our recent economic troubles, but there is no message apart from the obvious one that greed can lead people to be short-sighted and nasty. So I don't think the film is especially objectionable from a libertarian perspective.
I don't even know that it had anything to do with greed. I think it was just, here's a movie about people who are assholes. And if anything, it was more a movie about how, hey, here's how smoking crack can turn you into an asshole.
That does seem
because,
to be.
Because, I mean, these guys, they started out like normal dudes, like at the beginning of the movie. And then within a second of smoking a crack pipe, next thing you know, they're throwing midgets at the wall and snorting cocaine off of boogers' butts.
It does seem to be a significant turning point. Just finishing up this article here. From an artistic perspective, there's room for debate. You get the sense that the movie aspires to be Goodfellas, set in the financial world. It just is not that good. Like Goodfellas, it opens with a preview of an especially over-the-top scene from later in the film. It also uses a freeze-frame effect similar to anyone who has seen Goodfellas and has a similar narration from the main character. You can tell Scorsese is trying to create the similar visceral effect, but it's not quite there. Totally agree. But like nothing about it was particularly good. I even thought the editing was kind of sloppy for a movie that long. I mean, usually I think when you're trying to shorten a movie, and he did edit it, I think in this article is going to say from 4 hours down to three. But I mean, you would usually think that you would see sloppy editing in a shorter movie, right? Where you're trying to, you know, I mean, the ideal time for Hollywood movies is an hour and 40 minutes.
Yep.
Because you want to leave
less for comedy.
For what?
Yeah, it's like 89 minutes for a comedy.
Yeah, but Hollywood wants 100 minutes because then they can have the movie in the theater every 2 hours with 20-minute changeover.
I see.
So 100 minutes is like the golden number. While the broad strokes of the story may be true, many details feel false. The characters go from ordinary to outrageous too quickly.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. The office parties seem implausible in the 80s and the 90s after the rise of sexual harassment lawsuits and political correctness. And while Goodfellas recreated an Italian-American world with which Scorsese has some firsthand familiarity, Wolf creates a world whose look and feel he could only guess at, and you can tell. Also, he reportedly kept editing the movie to 3 hours down from four until the last minute. And it feels like he still didn't get it quite right. You get the sense there is a tighter, better movie that could have been made of it. Still, if you're not offended by the films that dwell on vice and crime and people who engage in them, it's worth seeing. Leonardo DiCaprio is great as always, and Jonah Hill is pretty good as his sleazy partner. Despite the excesses, I appreciated the depiction of how people can behave against their own long-run interests when they believe they've discovered a way to wealth and happiness that does not require them to think about how they can actually benefit their fellow man. Well said.
When former stockbroker Jordan Belfort was swindling investors out of $200 million, he probably didn't expect his exploits to be turned into a film. But after being caught, jailed, and becoming a best-selling author, that's exactly what's happened. And to top it all off, he's being played by one of the biggest names in Hollywood. Brian Seymour caught up with the real Wolf of Wall Street.
I was pushing the envelope every day of my life. Like everything I took five times the recommended dose. If I drank, I drank too much. If I drove my car, I drove too fast.
He hit the highest of highs during the 1990s, making $50 million a year. He had his own luxury yacht, a helicopter, the perfect wife and family, and every legal and illegal pleasure and addiction he could physically handle.
There is this sense that you've gotten away with it, scot-free. Is that true?
It's probably nothing could be further from the truth. For starters, I'm not even making any money off of the book or the movie. I've given 100% of both books and the movie to pay back investors. And I already paid a lot back. In fact, I think over 60% was paid back. And hopefully this could really round out the rest of that.
Yes, that's Leonardo DiCaprio playing The Wolf of Wall Street, directed by Martin Scorsese in a film that will be released here in November. 51-year-old Jordan Belfort became known as The Wolf of Wall Street after swindling nearly $200 million from investors in his New York share trading company, Stratton Oakmont.
Certainly at the heart of it was greed, no doubt about it. And the drugs then quieted the guilt and remorse that probably would have surfaced a lot earlier if I wasn't self-medicating back in the day.
While under the influence, Belfort trained young, ambitious traders to call clients and convince them to buy low-priced stocks of his choosing. It's called the pump and dump. This artificial demand saw the stock price climb until the wolf dumped all of his shares at a massive profit. Come the inevitable downturn, investors were left out of pocket and holding worthless shares. That little rort plus money laundering saw him jailed for 22 months.
I never thought the book would be made into a movie.
His book went ballistic, published in 75 countries. Belfort was ordered to hand over 50% of the profits. Now he wants to make that 100%, so he's not seen to be profiting from his ill-gotten gains.
I hope everyone gets all their money back now. There's a good shot they will. And I'll make my money off of doing my life the right way.
What is your business now?
My business now is primarily I work with large corporations and small mom-and-pop businesses and individual salespeople, train them in the art of selling slash influence slash persuasion.
Hello, I'm Leonardo DiCaprio, and some of you may know that I'll be playing Jordan Belfort in the new film, Wolf of Wall Street. What separates Jordan's story from others like it is the brutal honesty in which he talks about the mistakes that he's made in his life.
No doubt, Belfort's profile will skyrocket when The Wolf is released. But he's adamant he's learned his lessons.
When greed takes hold, it's about making as much as you can, as fast as you can.
Any way you can.
And you don't care who gets hurt along the way.
Everybody, welcome back to the School Sucks live show for January 3rd, 2014. I'm Brett. With me still is Osborne. Hey.
Hey.
And I'm so pleased to be joined once again by Jeffrey Tucker. How are you doing, sir? Great to have you back.
It's amazing to be here. I have such fabulous memories of being on your show the first time.
Oh, great. And we understand you were on Free Talk Live right before this?
I just got off. Yeah. I got, we talked all about my new company and, liberty.me and what's going on with that. And then I got various callers who, harassed me for, somebody I said the other day and so on. So it's okay. Everything's good.
Just another day in the life of Jeffrey.
Yeah. So the reason why I bring up your appearance on that show is I wanted you to have a chance to plug your new project up front here, liberty.me.
Yeah. Well, look, what can I say? It's my dream. It's all I've ever cared about, liberty. And now we have the technology to create a digital space, to provide a publishing platform, which I believe in. And I just think it needs to be used. So publishing platform, social network, and content delivery system based on the idea that human liberty is not just something you believe and think about, it's something you actually do. So I want to crowdsource ideas, and this space actually permits that, and I'm throwing everything I know and do at this project. So it's definitely on the bleeding edge. People say, oh, is liberty.me like, and as soon as they say like, and there's a fill in the blank, I just immediately cut them off and say no. because nothing like this has ever been created. I mean, I'm putting so many features within the structure of the web. I mean, I'm really out there. I just decided to dream big, and I found some investors, and we're just going to do it. That's, we've been working on it for 4 months. We've got about 2 months left, and we have we don't sleep much, actually. My team that's working on it, this is all we do. So
that's
fun.
Awesome. And yeah. Are you still involved with Laissez-Faire Books?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm still curating the books and writing summaries and writing articles and that sort of thing. So I've got my, it's funny. I mean, you know, the more I'm in this world, the more I feel like I can do. So I always, from my own point of view, I just, unless I'm slightly panicked and behind and worried that I'm not going to finish, then I'm not happy. So I like to live on adrenaline, anxiety. That's just kind of what makes me function. So that's why I took on Liberty.me. I wanted to do the most outrageous thing I could possibly think of. I mean, I want to change history, essentially. That's all. I want to push it further down the road. I want to do something insane and reckless and do something everybody says, don't do that. The more people that warned me against this, the more I felt the need to forge ahead, actually. So, you know, it's just, we have to begin imagining things that don't yet exist in order to make progress possible. So that's what this is all about.
So you refer to this as a publishing platform. What kinds of people are going to want to use this to publish?
Well, I mean, a lot of people are going to want to consume. I mean, part of it, you know, every act of entrepreneurship, I've noticed by looking at the biographies of people, a lot of times they begin with the desire of a person to do something himself or herself that they can't otherwise seem to do. And I've always wanted to have a really clean URL publishing platform where I don't have a gatekeeper, you know, where I can just kind of put, you know, say anything I want to say in my own space, and it'll be stable, and I can own that content. It'll be part of the commons. And I can really control it. So for me, as I thought about what the ideal domain would be, I found liberty.me, and I thought, well, I would love to be tucker.liberty.me. That's what I wanted to be as a person. I wanted to be able to wake up every day and publish my thoughts. And then I thought, well, you know, there's probably a lot of people that feel that way, actually. And now, you know, you sit down, you write an article and or have some thoughts on something, and you have to kind of go begging other people. Like, can you please publish this? Can you please publish that? Or you can start your own blog space and publish it and nobody sees it, right? So there's got to be some in-between solution. I mean, there's got to be a way to be able to have control of your content and also get an audience. So that's essentially the foundational insight that led to Liberty.me. I wanted people to be able to subscribe and have a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful web space that will exist alongside all the people that are already sort of experienced writers in the world of Liberty, and be able to publish alongside them, since I don't believe in gurus or experts anymore, actually. So I want everybody to have a chance to be able to influence the direction of history and to be able to market their ideas and get them out there with good SEO. By which I mean search engine optimization, so that people can actually get an audience without having to go through gatekeepers, without having to blend into the, you know, sea at Blogger or WordPress or whatever. So that was the first level insight. And then I also wanted to provide a kind of social networking opportunity, so for people to actually hang out, discuss, meet people, exchange ideas. That's the second level insight. And then the third one was essentially a belief that I think that we need to undergo a transformation in our thinking about strategy, and that strategy needs to move from just theory to practice. So we're also a content delivery system. So I've commissioned about 75 guides at this point that are providing very specific ways in which you can make changes in your own life to bring about a greater degree of freedom. So there's many aspects of the site. It's quite revolutionary. It's quite outrageous. But, you know, that's sort of what I do. So that's what I'm doing.
When you say there's no gatekeepers, so can someone get on there and create a site for the San Diego Chargers?
Yeah, or, probably. I mean, you know, yeah, but I've been, as long as I can remember in my professional life, people have warned me, you can't do that because people will abuse the system. And again, I found exactly the opposite, that the less control you have, the more order that emerges. So I believe in systems of anarchy. I believe in systems of no control. The more spontaneity you have, the better the results will be. So I think I can create a culture that will cause the best content to rise to the top. And so we have a commerce system, for example. Yeah. You know, I don't want to be a gatekeeper. As a matter of fact, I don't want to have any rights in this community over anyone else. You know, I want to see my content rise to the top just because it's really good.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I need that. You know, we all need that. We need that pressure. We should never live and rest on like our past accomplishments. I mean, like we should wake up every day and go, okay, let's say I'm born today. What am I going to do that's spectacular? So I want to face that fire. And so I'm creating a web space where I have to compete with hopefully 10, 20,000 other people for creating good space, good content. And I would love to see myself just buried, actually. And maybe this will happen. You know, I hope so.
I feel a similar way. We're actually transferring a School Sucks project in the coming months to a multi-site. So in other words, you go there, you make an account, and now there exists a URL called jeffreytucker.schoolsucksproject.com. And, you know, you have this partition of the site that you can use for your own content. And back to what you were saying before, that like, well, there's all these warnings that there'll be all this abuse. Well, there will be small cases of abuse, but I think, you know, filtering that stuff out is worth the opportunity that is created. And, you know, so many people send me emails and ask questions about education. And I say, go put this on the site, you know, where everyone can see it, you know, go crowdsource your
exactly.
answer. So I was a little, nervous, I think, cause years ago, once I started to get the hang of doing the podcast, I was like, oh yeah, everybody go start a podcast. And then I think everybody did. And, then I was like, oh no, now I think there's too many, you know, we might need some regulation here, Jeffrey. But,
I know that's right. You're losing your market share. Right.
Right. But then,
no,
but,
I mean, it's a transformation you have to make mentally and intellectually in life to finally believe in, I think the best word for it is to believe in open. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you open up, then you see great things come about. You see, and this is the market, right? I mean, we it's not controlled. It's not a controlled system. So we defer, we create you know, environments of freedom to allow new ideas to emerge that surprise us and shock us and allow everyone to play. That's the best way. I mean, messiness is the best path to beauty, I believe. So I want to create a messy, dangerous environment, you know, in the digital cloud for people to take risks and reinvent the idea of human liberty and crowdsource ideas for becoming freer. This is my dream. This is what I want to see achieved. And a lot of it is influenced by you know, the things that have happened over the last, you know, say 5 years. I mean, we've seen Bitcoin go from nothing to challenging world monetary systems. You know, we've seen corporations, major corporations, bail out of government-provided energy projects. We've seen the smartphone, you know, revolutionize, you know, the world so that the poorest of the poor suddenly have iPhones in their hands. I mean, there's all sorts of weird things happening in the world that are making this freer. And they've come about because people are taking crazy, outrageous risks through innovation. And I just think we need a space in the land of liberty that chronicles this and hopefully encourages the trend more and leads to greater innovation. I think we just need to imagine a future that's better than the past. That's all.
So do we want to spend some time talking about this film?
Why don't we? I mean, this is a kind of a controversial issue. The issue is a Wolf of Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And I went to the movie very excited because I like all kind of movies about Wall Street and drugs. right? Yeah. I mean, I like to watch every drug movie because I'm kind of interested in drugs because they're illegal. And I like movies about drugs because it tells me something I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in Wall Street. So I was very excited about this movie and I had to walk out after an hour. And, people's perspective on movies is so subjective. It's very difficult to kind of say that one view is right. But I was so disturbed by this film because it portrayed commerce in such a grim and ugly light. It upset me that, people were sitting out there who have never had any experience in financial markets at all. And this is their first sort of look at it, and this is what they're getting out of it. So that upset me. I understand it was based on a true story and all that, and that there are criminals and crooks in the world. But that aspect of things really upset me. And the sheer violence of and the misogyny actually really disturbed me. And I couldn't understand it, really. And I didn't understand why people would sit there and take it. So I thought, I'm just going to take it upon myself to leave right now and not have any part of it. And I'm a little bit embarrassed about my having left because I feel like a little bit of a Puritan because all my other friends said, oh, no, I stayed all the way to the end and it was actually quite marvelous. So, but I can only give my own impressions, and that's what they are.
So, I saw your post on Facebook, and I was saying in the first hour of the show, this was like the most anticipated movie of my life because Martin Scorsese is my favorite filmmaker by far. I think he's done some amazing work. I saw the first teaser trailer about 8 months ago, and I'm just basically counting down the days until then. So, I saw your post on Facebook that you had walked out of the movie. And I immediately text my co-host here. I say, we have to see this. Jeffrey Tucker walked out. We have to have him on the show. We have to have him on the show because there's no way that I'm not going to like this movie. And then I started to imagine that this debate that we would have. And we saw it maybe a day or two after I invited you on the show. And I didn't think it was that. I didn't think it was very good at all.
Oh, really? So yeah. Your sense was, did you experience boredom after the first hour? Like, I wasn't exactly protesting. I was just like bored. After about an hour, I thought, oh, to hell with it. I walked out.
I've seen enough people use drugs in my life that, seeing another 3 hours of it really doesn't thrill me a whole lot.
Yeah.
Okay, there we go. That's very interesting. So you were, I knew I was basically advertising for the film when I posted that status update. I thought, oh, now everybody's going to go see it.
The climb, the other thing that we identified in the article that we read in the first hour identified as well is that the climb was too fast. The arc was too steep for this character. And it would have been nice to, like, the abuse of drugs, and really to the point, I'm using the word abuse because he's totally sacrificing the long term, including a wife and a child for, short term gratification in sometimes very, very dangerous ways. And there's drugs are fun, sure, but there's a tragic aspect to his abuse of drugs. And it just seems like it turns on a dime. They smoke crack outside a bar, as Osborne pointed out, and then they were off and running. And, I didn't think the script was very good. I didn't think the characters were very well developed. And I think it kind of relied on gratuitous hedonism, as someone in the chat said, to drive the story. So,
And there's another thing, too. I mean, it's very interesting to me because, it had this weird effect on me. I'm not like Mr. Politically Correct or anything like that. But the misogyny in it disturbed me, like, profoundly. I mean, I started to feel very uncomfortable for every woman in the audience. I thought, this is just grim. It all began for me with the haircut scene, which I saw as clearly a metaphorical rape. I mean, I couldn't even stand watching that. And then it just got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I couldn't bear it anymore. I mean, it was just, there's something that was about the film that seemed to be assaulting human dignity, for half of humanity. And again, I feel like a prude or a Puritan or a severe, feminist or something like that, for saying these kind of things. But I found it just disturbing. And I didn't know why. I didn't know why the movie was made, and I didn't know why people were willing to put up with it, actually.
My theory, the story behind the movie is Brad Pitt tried to buy the rights to it. I guess Leonardo DiCaprio wound up buying the rights from Jordan Belfort and wanted Scorsese to direct it. And it's the kind of movie that is perfect for Martin Scorsese because, you know, the misogyny and a lot of the other sort of unsavory things that you see early in the movie is kind of setting the stage for what he does as a filmmaker and a storyteller best. He says, hey, look, here's some terrible people. Now watch me as I make you root for them. You know, I mean, if you look at movies like Goodfellas, Raging Bull, he takes these people who you would just run away from if you encountered them in real life, and he makes them the protagonist of the story. So unfortunately, I think that the scene that you're describing is they have a like a receptionist, or maybe she's a what do they call it? An investment associate who's actually taking phone orders after they close a deal. They bring her up in front of the whole company, and they shave her head and give her money to get breast implants. Which, it was kind of a disturbing scene. But I think initially, it's very clear that hey, these are if not bad people, confused or troubled people doing bad things. Now they will become center stage. They will become the protagonists of this film. And that that makes us uncomfortable. I was saying before, I think it makes it more interactive where, you know, Raging Bull is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I was sitting there and saying, am I rooting for this guy? Do I want this terrible human being to, you know, succeed? Am I sympathizing with such a person? So I think that that was why that would be one of my theories as to why the movie was made. Because it fits that genre that Martin Scorsese is so good at.
So do you think, I mean, this is what confused me about the film. Do you think that Scorsese expected the viewers to sympathize with this guy or no?
I don't think that he wants you to say, look at poor Jordan Belfort. You know, what he wants is you to recognize the turmoil in which this person lives, broken person, but he wants to make them the center of the story. That's a recurring theme in his movies. Kubrick, another great filmmaker, was the same way. All of the people that are center stage in his movies are horrifying. From Jack Nicholson in The Shining to HAL 9000.
But I you know, there's another problem with Wolf, I think, in that the plot was not complicated enough. There wasn't enough intrigue. I mean, there wasn't enough to engage. Maybe this is the bottom line. There wasn't enough to engage my intellectual imagination. I mean, I knew exactly where things were going, like from the very beginning, all the way to the end. I could write the script myself. And when you can see the narrative just like before you, it, for me, it became like a train wreck, you know, and I just didn't want to watch it because I knew where it was going and there was no interesting plot. I mean, unlike say Shining or something like that, which was interesting. I mean, you didn't know what was happening. There just wasn't enough complication.
That's why I don't feel bad about spoiling it. Cause really like
there's nothing to say. Yeah.
If you watch 15 minutes of the movie, you know what's going to happen. And I think we looked at each other, Jason, when we were watching it, we said, this is.
So my hope was actually that it was going to be another version of Wall Street, which I loved from the 1980s. You remember this?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is a great movie that was trying to condemn insider trading and make, you know, Wall Street look bad. But of course, every viewer was like wanting to be Gordon Gekko, you know, and in the end they had to, reach really far to make insider trading look like a bad thing. And mostly everybody walked out going, that's pretty cool. I want to be a Wall Street greedmeister, you know? And I love that movie. I love Gordon Gekko, actually. I thought it was just an amazing film. And despite the intention of the producer, the director, actually, I thought it would help to promote capitalism. And his greed speech was marvelous. I really liked that. I think it's entirely defensible. So I hope that Wolf would be the same way. And then I watched it and it was just like, it horrified me because I thought, you know, this is the worst thing for anybody to think that this is what commerce is like. This is what finance capitalism is like. And it gave me the chills that anybody would look to this guy as a hero. Maybe they wouldn't. I just don't really know. But I have to tell you that I've talked to a number of people who went to it. And very naively, they say, wow, I didn't know that that's what Wall Street was like.
Well, that's a shame, I think, if people walk away from it with that. And we talked about this a lot at dinner. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the stock market is a tool. Like a gun is a tool. You can use a gun to go out and hunt and catch dinner or protect your family, or you know, you can use a gun to collect taxes.
Right.
So I think the stock market is the same thing. It's very valuable and important for allowing companies to raise capital for growth. I mean, that's its proper primary function. But you know, I think that Stefan Molyneux, who's actually done a lot of good work on this subject, because he had some inside experience taking a company public years ago, said, well, you know, when you see a system like this that is just so largely confusing and disastrous and volatile, right, you know, ask yourself the question, where's the force? You know, it's like the Where's Waldo of violence, you know, like how do you find the state in this? And because of what I do, I try to say, you know, where's the school, you know, where's the schooling, residuals in Wall Street and so I see like a work pain association with the rise of speculation. People say, I can be successful without research, without work, you know, without patience. Yay. Cause I hated, how all those things were associated, with school. And, you know, another impact of schooling is that we are trained to defer to experts. Somebody calls us on the phone. They say, hey, buddy, I'm a stockbroker, okay? And you're just a guy. So, boy, have I got great information for you, which is basically what Belfort and his cohorts are doing in that movie. So another place that I look for school is, are people trying to take advantage of other people's ignorance?
God, no kidding.
So
yeah, that's really a good insight.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, maybe I was wrong to walk out. I mean, you know, some of the most disturbing scenes to me in that film, were when the guy was on the phone selling something, and on the other end of the phone, I mean, he's sort of making, you know, I'm screwing you, gestures and fuck you gestures. And, you know, he's saying one thing and believing he's doing another. Do you remember that stuff?
Yeah. That was pretty
so
powerful.
Upsetting to me because, I mean, that really upset me because the real world of commerce is actually not like that. Like, people cannot successfully, over long periods of time, rob others in a free market. That's not the way it works. You have to provide value to others who are consuming value. You're getting value. I mean, that's the magic of the market, is this mutually beneficial exchange. And to have it so aggressively and openly characterized as being basically, you know, one person robbing another, that among many aspects of the film really disturbed me. You know, I've been involved in markets, you know, in commercial sector my whole life. Okay, admittedly, I've never been a Wall Street trader or anything like that, but I've never known a business person who thinks of his or her life that way. They always have a kind of a dreamy belief that they're bringing something of value to others. And that's the way I like to think of commerce. And I mean, nothing in my experience and in my life contradicts that. And then I go to this movie and it's like, you know, characterizing all of economic exchange as basically robbery. You know, that upset me to see it. I didn't like that. And people like that fail. And it's true that in the film, he failed, right? So that's maybe, in a way, it could be seen as a kind of a parable of how to lose in business, not win, you know. But at the same time, as I say, I didn't see the whole thing. Did you say through the whole film you didn't leave out?
We did, yeah. I feel a certain loyalty to the filmmaker that, and really, like 45 minutes into it, I was like, this is not good. I want this to be good. You know, I want this to be my favorite movie ever, but it just is not that good. The script was bad. It was edited very choppily. And but just back to what you said, I want to throw this to Osborne real quick. When you're looking at that character Osborne of Jordan Belfort, could you identify anybody from your life? Like, you know, Jeffrey saying that nobody in his life is like that, or that he doesn't remember running into those kind of characters. Have you experienced a person who was that ruthless?
Personally, I can't think of one.
Yeah, I only ever did once, and it was somebody who worked on Wall Street, and they had, you said, Jeffrey, they had this kind of dreamy story about how they were making the world a better place through what they did. And of course, everyone wants to believe that. But even if you can't come up with like that kind of a pure, wonderful, inspiring kind of story to tell yourself, what this person would say to me is, look, the average person is an idiot. They're getting what they deserve. They're sheep. And, you know, I'm providing a valuable service. And unfortunately, you know, the financial services market, I think, is responsible for propping up a lot of bad things. You know, I mean, obviously, yeah, the government gets a lot of obviously, in its purest form, the stock market is a good thing. There's no question about that. But this also comes back to what I was saying when we opened the conversation about is government schooling creating distortions in what should be a market. And I think Wall Street is another prime example of this, not with maybe so much with schooling, but with the state itself. So you're right. People like Jordan Belfort wouldn't last 5 minutes in a truly free market.
No, I think that's right. But, you know, but the other thing I have to tell you that, and if you don't mind my interjecting this passing comment here, I've known a lot of really rich people, actually, mm-hmm. who've made a lot of money in the market. None of them are like this guy, Jordan Belfort. I mean, they don't spend recklessly. Actually, they're weirdly penurious and reserved about their spending. In fact, most of the wealthiest people I've ever known are ridiculously scrupulous about their spending, actually. And they're not materialistic. I mean, you only have to look at people like Steve Jobs, you know, for example, who lived like, you know, some sort of monk or something. I mean, this is actually not atypical. This is the very, very wealthy get rid of their property. They are ridiculously conservative in their spending. And that's one of the reasons they're rich. I mean, our caricature of the way the rich live is actually the way the poor live. I mean, just sort of squandering everything.
Yeah. You know,
in the high life. And our caricature of the way the poor live is actually the way the rich tend to live. I mean, the very rich are very interesting bunch in that way.
But there's
They're
an
not
interesting
materialistic.
Here's an interesting thing though that connects there's two different kinds of rich that there's the people who are rich like Jordan Belfort and people who are rich like Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
And the difference is that connects somebody like Jordan Belfort more to the recklessness of, say, somebody who is on welfare and lives at the maximum level of decadence for that income, is they are treating their assets like a stolen car because they know they didn't earn them. So when Belfort in his mid-20s gets rich doing something so simple requiring, you know, I'm thinking that what he did probably require, and I've watched interviews with him, and he is a smart guy, and he did come up with, it wasn't an honest sales formula, but it was a sales formula, and he was somewhat innovative in what he was doing. But I think it happened so fast, and from what I've gathered from his story, it ultimately felt so unearned that when you work your way up like Steve Jobs and you build all that stuff basically from the ground up, you have a great appreciation for what you have and a great care for the assets that you accumulate. And maybe that just isn't the case with, I mean, what happens to lottery winners? They're usually bankrupt 4 years later. You know, that's recurring theme and I think that this kind of wealth that people like Belfort accumulated at this incredibly volatile time, it didn't feel earned. And that might have contributed to the recklessness. But I agree with you if what you're saying is this movie makes it look like that is Wall Street. I think that's wrong.
And when you get money, this is what you do. And I can tell you that is not true. I mean, every really heavily capitalized person I know is ridiculously far-seeing. They do not squander money at all. They think only about the ridiculously long-term. I mean, I'm talking about generations. They think about building dynasties. You know, they're thinking about their great-grandchildren. I mean, people haven't even been born yet. That's the way the really, really rich actually think. I mean, I can tell you hilarious stories about the really, really rich. I mean, they're not like us. They like today. Okay, so I wanted to, I woke up with a hankering for a new rabbit fedora, and I couldn't get rid of it. So I called all over the country, and I found just the right shop that had just the right rabbit fedora, but actually they corrected me on the phone and called it a hare fedora. I don't know what the hell the difference is between a hare and a rabbit, but anyway, and I squandered, you know, like $250 on this hat. Okay, you know what? The very rich don't do that kind of stuff. They'll wake up in the morning and want a new fedora and go buy it. They would never even consider that because that's $250 they would never spend. They're thinking about the third generation, you know, after them, and they save money. They're incredibly scrupulous. They're almost puritanical in their spending. They watch every dime. And that's one of the reasons they're super wealthy. I'm talking about the super rich, not just like the moderately wealthy, but the super rich. Mm-hmm. Do not live anything like the way that movie portrayed them. So I would like to. I'm disturbed slightly about the message that movie gave to people. Like, well, gosh, if I had a lot of money, then I could just pay any woman to be abused by me, and wouldn't that be marvelous? Like, right. I'm not into that message. Actually, no, I think that's a really dreary thing.
Not at all, Osborne. Go ahead.
A couple of things. First of all, Jeffrey, I just myself picked up two rabbit fedoras in the last week, a beautiful blue one and an orange one, and I have just the shop for you. This place is absolutely amazing. They stock 9,000 hats at all times and overturn 30% of their inventory every 30 days. So it's just it's amazing. It's a mecca of hat shopping. It's called Selma Gundy, and it's in Boston. And every time I drive down there, I've got to stop.
Oh, my God. I didn't know about it. I wish we had talked earlier. Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I was all over the place. I ended up, you know where I ended up, right? Maybe you don't know, but I called Cable Car Clothiers in San Francisco, actually. Sure. And they only claim to have hundreds of hats. That's like 10,000.
Well, it might work for you with your particular head size, but with mine... like I'll be doggone if I can find a hat that fits my head. So guys, 62, 63.
I don't know what that means. Is it like 7.5, 7.58, 7.75?
This would be like 7.875.
Ooh, yeah, that's big. That means you're very smart. No, I don't know. I don't know what that means. I wear a 7.625, and I have a difficult time trying to get a hat too. This is talk about inside baseball, right? I mean, but anyway.
Anyway, and the second point is I realized, Brett, why you probably asked me that question earlier about if I'd ever known anyone like this, because as you may remember, Jeffrey, I'm in the debt collection business.
Which, that's right. That's so cool.
Aside from Wall Street, probably the most reviled industry in the country or world. And I still, even in that industry, I don't know anyone that behaves like this guy Belfort, or for that matter, like any of the news stories that you hear about my industry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Again, and just like in this movie, these people who act like this are people who open up a fly-by-night shop, they can operate for a few months, and then they get shut down for doing dumb and illegal and just wrong things.
I don't know what your time constraints are, but do you mind if I tell a quick story about the first rich, really rich person I ever knew?
Here's the fun thing about this show, and really, frankly, what makes it better than Free Talk Live. We have no time constraints. We have no breaks. We can stay here till midnight Eastern. We can end in a half hour. It's up to you. So, you know, this movie is our anchor, and there's a few more things I want to discuss, but there's no way people aren't going to enjoy the show or going to shut it off if you have an occasional tangent. So please, by all means.
This is just a funny story. Okay,
sure, sure.
So there was a funny man that I worked for. And his he made $1 gazillion in the oil industry, right? And then his wife is bored. So he opened up a dress shop for her, and she was a brilliant dress buyer and an entrepreneur. And she made $1 gazillion in the dress business. And I sold clothes there. That was back in the 80s when, you know, every woman had to have a matching purse and shoes in exotic leathers. And maybe not every woman, but the people who shopped here had to. And then he decided he would open up his own men's shop, but he tapped me to do it. So, and I was just a kid. So I ran his like high-end men's store. Like if you didn't want to spend, and we're talking about 30 years ago, 20 years ago, if you didn't want to spend $500 on a pair of pants, you just didn't walk in the store. I mean, that's how ridiculously high end of the store was. And the guy who owned it was, you know, absurdly. I mean, it was my first encounter with somebody at that level. And anyway, I remember hearing him on the phone one day, and he was talking to contractors who were refurbishing the entry to his house. And I had been to his house many times. The entry to his house was perfectly fine. But he was going to spend $600,000 to refurbish the entry into his house, into a marble place. And he was going to be a marble imported from Italy. And he was working with contractors like all the time on the phone. I could hear him on the phone. And so you can kind of gain a sense of the realities here, right? And we're talking about stuff that normal people don't think about. And so he was talking to the contractors, and one day he got on the phone and he began to yell at somebody, and he was a painter. And the painter had painted the inside of the closet in the front entryway that was being redone in marble for $600,000. And the contractor explained that he had just finished painting the inside of the closet, and my boss, owner of the men's store, lit into him and said, that is an outrage. How much of my money have you spent painting the inside of this closet? This is squandering money. This is, you never asked me. Nobody ever sees the inside of a closet. You're robbing me blind. Okay, so he told this to this poor painter. And I don't know how much money the painter spent painting the inside of the closet. Maybe it's $40. You know?
Yeah.
What does that compare to $600,000? But I remember thinking at the time, I thought, there is a slight bit of insanity, you know, in the heart of this complaint. You know, a sort of distorted sense of reality, you know, is going on here.
Well, I don't know about that, because I mean, I find myself in situations like this with the people who work for me. And it's not the particular instance that you discover that's the problem. It's the fact that there's probably hundreds of other of those instances that you don't discover.
I know. There's a wonderful book I read some years ago, and it was a bestseller. It stayed on the New York Times bestseller list so long, they actually took it off the bestseller list and put it under the popular paperback series or whatever their secondary thing is. It's called Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Have you read it? Have you heard of it?
Yes. Yeah, it's a very good read. And by Robert Kiyosaki, and he's kind of talking about these two father figures that he has in his life. Yep. One is very rich, the other one is a government employee, and despite having probably a somewhat inflated salary for whatever he's involved in doing with the government, is always struggling with money and making bad decisions.
I love that book in so many ways, because it really turns the world upside down. It makes you realize, you know, something like what I said earlier, that the rich live like the poor and the poor live like the rich, you know, and that's the right way to go about managing your money. I mean, people who are really rich don't wake up in the morning like I do and want a rabbit fedora and are willing to spend any amount of money to get it.
No, it's interesting too, because you know, I mean, I felt like the last few years for me have kind of been a struggle, and things are starting to turn a corner now. And my thoughts go to what can be bought, right? Instead of how can this translate to the long term, you know? So I feel like I'm engaging in that kind of thinking as well. I remember making significantly more money, there was a kind of a calm in the present moment, where the only place for attention to go was to the long term. Do you know what I mean? Because the present moment is taken care of, right? There are no immediate unmet survival or financial needs right now. So my attention and my efforts can be deferred, you know, and I can start planning for the future. But I think for a lot of people who are living paycheck to paycheck or even hand to mouth, the future is like, I don't even want to acknowledge that there's going to be a future.
Right.
You know, I don't want to think about that, because you know, if it's anything like the struggle that I'm engaged in now, I just rather pretend it doesn't exist. But when,
you know, one of the things that's really interesting about this whole sort of time horizon point of view, 100 years ago, you know, we had come out of the Gilded Age, where there was a whole generation, several generations, that were really planning for their grandchildren, great-grandchildren. I mean, they were thinking about 100, 200 years ahead. And then everything changed with several big institutional shifts in American life. The inheritance tax was a grim and horrible thing because it looted people on the death. So it deliberately shortened their time horizons. So forget the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. Now it's like, I got to get what I'm going to get, and screw my children. So that was a horrible innovation. Horrible. It changed the culture entirely. The income tax was grim. And then you had the invention of the Federal Reserve, you know, which just deliberately started depreciating the money, which gives you the incentive to spend now rather than save. I mean, you're punished for saving, essentially. Yeah. So you had these huge changes that took place between like the 1890s and the 19-teens, late 19-teens, when the whole world went into upheaval, you know?
Yeah.
When the whole culture just dramatically changed. If you ever want to see a visual representation of this, head over to Newport, Rhode Island, which is a beautiful town in so many ways. But you'll see the mansions of the late Gilded Age and what they built and what they were thinking and what they believed about themselves. You'll see a visual representation of what it's like, really, to have an aristocratic, deeply embedded, dynastic, free market culture. You know, in those mansions, you see everything. And you know what's amazing about those places? They were all abandoned by the children and the grandchildren. They just walked away and said, screw this place. I can't keep it up. It's too expensive.
Was it because, all right, I'm wondering, you know, I mean, there were a lot of people who, you know, worked their way up, you know, in the latter half of the 1800s, and have this story that they either had this kind of market, some people had this market myopia where, you know, cars come along and they say, well, that's okay, I'm in the railroad business, you know, and then planes come along and they say, well, that's okay, I'm in the railroad business, and they don't realize that they're in the transportation business. So people who couldn't adapt to changes in the market went broke, but there's also stories about as the wealth continues.
Yeah. It's taxation. I mean, the state looted this generation. I mean, you know, I mean, that was grim. That level of taxation did not apply to the middle class, but it applied to the very rich. I mean, who's that asshole? Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt. He wanted to destroy these people, and he did, actually. You know, it was catastrophic. Really.
So let me ask you this, though. There's a book that Rothbard wrote in the early 80s, and I'm wondering if you've read it or not. It's called Wall Street Banks and America's Foreign Policy.
Yeah. Right?
Because it seems like what Rothbard explains in that story is that there was at least a handful of families, and I can name a couple of them, Rockefeller and Morgan, who seemed to find a way around most of the state's predation and actually... you know, according to the story that Rothbard tells, largely through the foreign policy exploits of the 20th century, put the state to work for them. Yeah, and this was disturbing for me too, because I talked to Tom Woods about this a while ago, and he said, you know, don't make John Rockefeller and the Rockefeller Foundation the same thing. Don't make a man who worked his way up from nothing and this foundation that sought to impose itself on the minds and bodies of all people in America. I don't know if you're familiar with the Rockefeller Education Board or the investigation in the 1950s into tax-free foundations. But it seemed like there were a couple periods in history where, you know, there were people who were extremely wealthy, and they said, you know, as I would say, you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. I would say this happened again during FDR in a big way, where they said, okay, enough of this shit. What we need to do is figure out how to either beat these people, resist these people, or control these people. And it seems like there was a contingent of 19th century wealth that was able to get in a position of power beyond the state. And that's the story that Rothbard tells in that book. And I've been down on Wall Street, even though I recognize the valuable function that exists through the stock exchange. But there's nuance there, right? Like, I never on my show, especially when I'm talking to young people, I never want to demonize wealth. I hope they're all millionaires. But I also want them to understand nuance, right? So when we were talking before about distortions, there's ways that, you know, I think that a lot of times I listen to conservative talk radio and they're trying to draw this clear line, and the liberals do this too, between government and business, you know? And I think there's more of a tangled web there in a lot of cases. And the stock market is a good example of that, because there's a lot of money forced into the stock market that creates distortions, you know, pensions for public employees, Social Security, government bonds, you know, all these things allow all this, they force people's money into the stock market. 15% of everybody's income is being invested in the stock market, and that can lead to some recklessness. But
I think everything you've said is exactly right. The only thing I would add to that is to provide a slight point of clarification on this. And this is where I think basically the left goes wrong.
Sure.
They look at the Wall Street and they go, look at all the corruption. It's just ghastly. The only thing, the libertarian insight here, and I think it's a very powerful one, is to say that the only reason that private parties are able to get away with basically criminality and corruption over the long term is because of the existence of the state.
Yep.
So yes, government is a problem, and yes, Wall Street is a problem. And in some sense, sometimes it looks like the private corporate cartel is a more of a problem than even in Congress or the Supreme Court or the presidency, you know?
Yeah.
The critical thing to recognize is that there are, the state has a unique sort of feature to it, namely that it's able to get away with mass coercion legally. And Wall Street and the private sector is not, except to the extent it allies itself with the government. So between the two, we have to recognize that, you know, what is a necessary and sufficient condition for wrecking society? And I would say that is the state. It's not finance capitalism.
No, absolutely.
And that's a subtle point, but and I think Rothbard would certainly agree with this. You know, it's not as if Wall Street creates a state, you know, or sustains it. It's in a way, you know, the state is what sustains the private criminality, the cartels, and the corruption.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I agree with that.
Or to put it in a way our younger demographic might understand, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Okay, so that's, I find this more and more on podcasts. I take up way too much time saying something that somebody else can say in a much shorter space. That's exactly it.
All right, so we'll let you go. We'll see you in a month. Thank you again so much for your time and for participating in our conversation. We will talk again soon, sir.
Lovely to be with you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Folks, what a place. Okay, gang, time for some facts. We are going to start today with Christopher R., who is from Somerville, Massachusetts, not too far away from me at all. And let me tell you this, Alexander Graham Bell, who gets credit for inventing the telephone, first demonstrated it in nearby Boston in the 1870s, but the first actual telephone line was installed in a home in Somerville, Massachusetts. Next, we have Benjamin W. He is from Columbia, South Carolina. People of Columbia were pioneers in being victims of domestic terrorism. On February 17th, 1865, much of the city was destroyed by fire while being occupied by William Tecumseh Sherman's Union Army. That's right. Moving right along, we've got Colin D. in Malakuta, which is in Victoria, Australia. And here's the interesting thing about Malakuta, all right, that you should know. It's small town, you know, coastal, beautiful. During most of the year, at least according to recent census figures, town has a population of under 1,000. But because of surfing and golf attractions, during the summer, the population swells to sometimes over 10,000. So bring your clubs and your board to Malakuta. Next, we have Jonathan B., who is in Vashon, Washington. Oh, wouldn't you know? The home of John Ratzenberger, who played Cliff Clavin on Cheers. And I also learned that Mr. Ratzenberger started a school in Vashon while he lived there. Moving right along, we have Justin P., who is in San Jose, California. Folks, what a place. Highest median household income in the nation. Third safest city in California. The oldest civilian settlement in California, founded all the way back in 1777. Also the leader, the world leader in patent generation. But what can you really expect when you've got 6,600 technology companies operating in San Jose currently? And we'll finish up today with Leander P., who is from Green River, Wyoming. Listen to this. Green River produces a majority of the world's soda ash, an industrial chemical used in glass and cleaning products. So folks, you know what? Thanks someone from Green River if you've ever enjoyed the convenience of glass, like in a window. All right.
New subscriber geography trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.